discovered Jean's body, lying on a pile of pillows at the end of the bathtub with her head submerged in the partly filled tub. For whatever reason, Professor Tatlock did not call the police. Instead, he picked his daughter up and laid her on the sofa in the living room. On the dining room table, he found an unsigned suicide note scribbled in pencil on the back of an envelope. It read in part, "I am disgusted with everything. To those who loved me and helped me, all love and courage. I wanted to live and to give, and I got paralyzed somehow. I tried like hell to understand and couldn't. I think I would have been a liability all my life. At least I could take away the burden of a paralyzed soul from a fighting world." From there the words ran into a jagged, illegible line. Stunned, Tatlock began rummaging about the apartment. Eventually, he found a stack of Jean's private correspondence and some photographs. Whatever he read in this correspondence inspired him to light a fire in the fireplace. With his dead daughter stretched out on the sofa beside him, he methodically burned her correspondence and a number of photographs. Hours passed. The first phone call he made was to a funeral parlor. Someone at the funeral parlor finally called the police. When they arrived at 5:30 p.m., accompanied by the city's deputy coroner, papers were still smoldering in the fireplace. Tatlock told the police that the letters and photos had belonged to his daughter. 4.5 hours had passed since he had discovered her body. Professor Tatlock's behavior was, to say the least, unusual. But relatives who stumble upon the suicide of a loved one often behave oddly. That he methodically searched the apartment, however, suggests that he may have known what he was looking for. Clearly, what he saw in Jean's papers motivated him to destroy them. It wasn't politics. Tatlock sympathized with many of his daughter's political causes. His motive can only have been something more personal. The coroner's report stated that death had occurred at least 12 hours earlier. Jean had died sometime during the evening of Tuesday, January 4, 1944. Her stomach contained considerable recently ingested semi-solid food and an undetermined quantity of drugs. One bottle labeled Abbott's Nembutal C was found in the apartment. It still contained 2 tablets of the sleeping pills. There was also an envelope marked codeine, half grain, that contained only traces of white powder. Police also found a tin box labeled Upjohn Racephedrin Hydrochloride, 3/8 grain. The tin still contained 11 capsules. The coroner's toxicological department conducted an analysis of her stomach and found barbituric acid derivative, a derivative of salicylic acid, and a faint trace of chloral hydrate, uncorroborated. The actual cause of death was acute edema of the lungs with pulmonary congestion. Jean had drowned in her bathtub. At a formal inquest in February 1944, a jury determined Jean Tatlock's death to be suicide, motive unknown. The newspapers reported that a $732.50 bill from her analyst, Dr. Siegfried Bernfeld, was found in the apartment, evidence that she had taken her own troubles to a psychologist. Actually, as a psychiatrist in training, Jean was required to undergo analysis and pay for it herself. If recurring episodes of manic depression drove her to suicide, it was tragic. By all accounts, her friends thought that she had reached a new plateau in her life. Her achievements were considerable. Her colleagues at Mount Zion Hospital, the foremost center in Northern California for training analytic psychiatrists, thought her an outstanding success and were shocked that she had taken her own life. When Jean's childhood friend Priscilla Robertson learned of her death, she wrote her a posthumous letter, trying to understand what had happened. Robertson did not think a personal heartbreak would have pushed Jean to suicide. "For you were never starved for affection. Your insatiable hunger was for creativity, and you longed to find perfection in yourself, not out of pride, but in order to have a good instrument to serve the world. When you found that your medical training, completed, did not give you all the power for good that you had hoped for, when you found yourself entangled in the small routine of hospital conventions and in the huge messes which the war made in the lives of your patients, far beyond any doctor's power to patch up, then you turned, in your 11th hour, again to psychoanalysis." Robertson speculated that perhaps it was this experience, which always brings introspective despair in mid-course, that had stirred up agonies too deep to be assuaged. Robertson and many other friends were unaware that Tatlock was struggling to cope with issues surrounding her sexual orientation. Jackie Oppenheimer later reported Jean as telling her that her psychoanalysis had revealed latent homosexual tendencies. At the time, Freudian analysts regarded homosexuality as a pathological condition to be overcome. Sometime after Jean's death, one of her friends, Edith Arnstein Jenkins, went for a walk with Mason Roberson, an editor of People's World. Roberson had known Jean well, and he said that Jean had confided to him that she was a lesbian. She told Roberson that in an effort to overcome her attraction to women, she had slept with every bull she could find. This prompted Jenkins to recall one occasion when she had entered the Shasta Roadhouse on a weekend morning and seen Mary Ellen Washburn and Jean Tatlock sitting up and smoking over the newspaper in Mary Ellen's double bed. In remarks suggesting her perception of a lesbian relationship, Jenkins later wrote in her memoir that Jean seemed to need Mary Ellen, and she quoted Washburn as saying, "When I first met Jean, I was put off by her large breasts and her thick ankles.